Well, thank you very much for coming back. So this afternoon I'm going to now talk about radical construction grammar and the basic assumption that it makes. So I'll start just to quickly review the basic ideas that I described this morning. Once I get this to work. So basic construction grammar is what I described this morning, and it's pretty straightforward. Grammatical knowledge is represented as constructions, pairings of form and meaning. An example of that is what you see at the top of the slide. So the English comparative construction has a description that you see there on the top, and then down here is a summary of its meaning. Constructions may be complex or atomic, that is, single words or morphemes, that's atomic, and schematic or substantive or anything in between. And then constructions can be organized into taxonomic hierarchies, as with the example down there on the bottom here. So that's just a review of the basic principles that I told you are common to all different types of construction grammar. And then another quick review here is the internal structure of a construction. This is the exploded diagram. So the important thing to look at now is you have a construction here and its parts, and the syntactic roles is the role that each part plays in the whole construction. Syntactic relations is what goes between the two constructions. We're going to be talking about syntactic roles today. This afternoon. I'll talk about syntactic relations tomorrow, I guess it is. Symbolic relations are the relations that link the elements to their meanings and also the whole structure. I won't be talking too much about that today. So the important thing is this notion of a syntactic role. Okay, now I told you about radical construction grammar, and someone asked me at the end of the morning lectures, what makes it different from other kinds of construction grammars? And basically, one way of looking at it is what radical construction grammar does not have. So first, there are no syntactic categories, those are the roles I just described, independent of the constructions that define them. That's what I'll be talking about this afternoon, lecture two, and tomorrow morning. There are also no syntactic relations. So those we can do without entirely. We have only syntactic roles, those part-whole relations. And I'll be talking about that tomorrow afternoon. And then there are also no universal formal construction types. I alluded to this this morning. That's going to be lecture five. That's Sunday morning. So these are the principles I'm going to be arguing for, or rather arguing against today. So what do we use instead? Because if you get rid of all this stuff, we have to have something to capture grammatical structures and grammatical generalizations. So syntactic role categories are defined by semantic maps over conceptual spaces which constrain them. This is lectures 7 and 8. These are the lectures on Tuesday that I mentioned before. So I'm afraid you'll have to wait. I hope some of you will still be here on Tuesday to hear about that. Symbolic relations allow syntactic roles to be related to one another semantically. So that's what we use instead of syntactic relations, and I'll talk about that tomorrow afternoon. And then a syntactic space defines a constrained continuum of formal construction types. So constructions may vary across languages, but again, there are limits to that variation, or at least some kinds of constraints on them, and I'll talk about that on Sunday. So today we're going to talk and focus on syntactic categories. Can you read that? I can barely read it from here. It's that green color. Can you see that at all? Uh-oh. I may have to do some changing of my slides tonight. Okay, so this is about syntactic categories. And the issues here I'm going to go into have to do not just with what counts as a syntactic category, or how you define them in your grammatical analysis, but also how do you defend them? How do you decide that they actually exist in the language? And so most of what I'll talk about today has to do with what's called syntactic argumentation, how you construct arguments to support an analysis, a linguistic analysis. And this is what I'll be mainly criticizing. So in the Western linguistic tradition, syntactic argumentation is originally about what's called the distributional method. So syntactic categories, that is word classes, like noun or count noun or classifier, but also classes of larger units like phrases, subjects, and so on, clauses, relative clause, adverbial clause, are determined by the distributional method. And you'll see what that is in a moment. The distributional method is a term that was used by in the linguistic theory called American structuralism from the 1930s and 40s. It's not dead. It continues on in new names. They're referred to typically as tests or criteria or arguments or evidence for a syntactic category. So you might see tests for defining a direct object or criteria for deciding whether or not Mandarin has adjectives and arguments for or against the existence of adjectives and so on. Oh, good, you can see that. So this is a simple example. This is how you would distinguish between adjectives and verbs in English. So instead of doing it in sort of a verbal description, I've given you the actual kinds of examples that are really necessary to establish this fact. So the first example, you see the word cold, and you can see that it is used with the copula B, Jack is cold. You cannot use it without the copula, and you cannot inflect it. So 1B is unacceptable, Jack colds. And then happy works the same way. Jack is happy is what you have to say with a word like happy. On the other hand, words like dance, you don't use them with a copula. You use them without the copula, as in 3B, Jack dances, and you have to inflect it. And the same, of course, is true for sing. So, of course, that's the distinction between a verb and an adjective in English. And we can describe this in terms of its distribution. So the term distribution means, or criteria means, you've got one particular construction, you have a particular role in that construction, which I've left blank here, and then you have some words that can fit in that role, and other words that can't fit in that role. And then likewise, you have another construction, and you have an empty role here, which is essentially inflection and no copula, just the subject. And then you have words that can't occur in that construction, and other words that can occur in that construction. So you have a contrast here, and this is what's described as a difference in syntactic distribution or syntactic behavior, or you would call these two constructions tests or criteria or arguments to establish the verb-adjective contrast in English. So that's how the method works. And basically, every serious syntactician uses this method. There's really no other way to define categories. Now, I've already said this, but I will have to say this again, which is that all these things, tests, criteria, arguments, evidence, and so on, for syntactic categories and other syntactic constructs, those are really just constructions. So if we go back, these things that are the test of the distributional patterns, these are constructions. The distribution is a particular role in that construction. So you start by assuming that there are constructions here. You can't use the distributional method without assuming the existence of these two constructions, for example. So you can't define verb and adjective in English without assuming already the existence of two different constructions, the copula construction and the simple inflected predicate construction. Now the thing is, and this is an important point, I actually did not really make this point clear in my book Radical Construction Grammar. It's something that came out later in terms of discussions. But in fact, when you look at these non-construction grammars that use this method of syntactic argumentation, they are implicitly assuming the existence of constructions because they use this in the method. But they don't use the name for that, and we'll see an example of that later. Instead, they use all the other names I've got listed on the in the first bullet point. So what's the standard view of syntactic categories? I mean, how would you do this? This is kind of what you would learn in an introductory linguistics and certainly an introductory syntax class. So we find constructions that identify the syntactic categories that we believe to exist, like verb and adjective in English. There's a further assumption that there's a small number of large word classes for the major parts of speech. So we should, in principle, be able to find things like noun, verb, and adjective, or subject and object, or whatever you're looking for. Another assumption that's made here is that we can differentiate major classes, like verb, from subclasses, like transitive verb and intransitive verb. A fourth assumption that's made is that these classes are cross-linguistically valid, if not found in all languages. So for instance, once we've identified adjectives in a language like English, we can then move on to a language like Mandarin or Cantonese and then say, this language has adjectives, or this language does not have adjectives. And then the last point was actually the most crucial one, and this is something I also don't, well, I talk a little bit about this in the book, and that is that these word classes are the basic building blocks of larger syntactic constructions, larger syntactic structures, including constructions. And that's why this, all the assumptions on this slide are so important to so many syntacticians, is because of that last point. This is the building block model of syntax. And what I'm going to say is this is a very deeply rooted assumption about how you analyze syntactic structures. I would imagine that most of you assume it, or were at least taught to assume it. It's a model that goes way back earlier than generative grammar, so I'm not just criticizing generative grammar here or even American structuralism. This goes way, way back. And that's why I emphasize it, because it is so difficult, because I'm going to tell you that it's wrong, and so I will have to try to persuade you about why this is the wrong way to look at syntax, and this might be difficult, as you'll see when I discuss other linguists who I've criticized in print about this. So this traditional model of syntactic categories, like noun, verb, and adjective, presupposes the building block model of syntax. In the building block model, syntactic structures, i.e. constructions in our view, are built out of their elements. So this transitive construction here is built. You take the NP category, combine it with a verb, then you take that and combine it with another NP, which is for English, and you end up with the English transitive construction. So in other words, if these are the building blocks of grammar, of syntax, then it's really important to know what type each building block is. It's important to know that this is a verb and not an adjective, for example, because you can't build it if it's an adjective. So what's wrong with this picture? Basically, everything that I told you before. So first point, which I'll be spending a lot of today on, is that we can't use just any construction to identify word classes. The second point is that words, or for that matter, phrases, do not form large distributionally uniform classes. Nor can we differentiate major classes from subclasses. Instead, word classes are language specific, and therefore they cannot be used to have some kind of cross-linguistic category of adjective that you would find in both English and some other language. And basically the bottom line is that the building block model of syntax doesn't work. So these are strong statements, but I'll hope to be able to show you why this is really the better way to look at language. So what's being described? So here's an example. A different example, it's from my book, looking at the direct object. So you have these expressions in boldface. So Jack kissed Janet. In this construction, it's the object. And in the passive construction, the same object can be made into the subject of the passive construction. A cane, however, in this construction, it doesn't occur as an object. It has to have the preposition with a cane. The old man walked with a cane. And then you cannot make it the passive subject. So that looks fine. We have two tests for the direct object category. And the direct object works. It fills this role here and it fills this role here. And a cane doesn't work in either of these constructions. So the traditional solution here is to call the first thing a direct object and the second an oblique phrase. The only trouble is this doesn't always work. So you can say Jack weighs 160 pounds. So it looks like it fits the active construction, but 160 pounds was weighed by Jack is unacceptable. So in other words, the two tests, if you go back, let me back up. See, the two tests match here. This word fits both of them. This word fails both of them. Here they don't. It fits the first test, the active construction, but it doesn't fit the role in the second construction. So what do linguists do in this case? So this is a fact about English. So we can't really deny this fact. But so what do linguists do when you see this? The usual strategy is, if you have two constructions that don't match, is you pick one of these constructions and say, this gives you the real answer to the question, is 160 pounds the direct object of weigh or not? In this case, the usual strategy is to take actually the second sentence as the one that tells you what is a true direct object in English. And then since the 160 pounds is not acceptable, then you say that it's not a direct object. A little problem comes up, though, which is that 160 pounds still is acceptable in this sentence, and now we have no explanation for why, because it's supposedly not a direct object. But more important, and this is the crucial point here, is that these facts I've just given you, very simple facts about English, tells you, it's not really telling you something about a category direct object. And we're trying to figure out why or it is or isn't. If you decide that the passive sentence is your true test for a direct object, what you're really doing is you're telling me something about the passive construction, except you're pretending it's about direct objects. But since you've decided direct objects are defined by that passive construction, then you're really telling me something about the passive construction. And that's really a very important point. That's why this is a talk about construction grammar. In my book, I describe this as methodological opportunism. And this is going to be the first of a series of examples where I take analyses that have been published by other linguists. And in this particular case, I actually wrote a comment or critique of this particular analysis. And the author was able to respond to me, and then I was able to respond later on in another publication. So the example that he looked at is the English word since. Now, the traditional grammatical analysis of since is that the sentences you see on the screen illustrate three different categories. The first one is a preposition because it governs a direct object, since the party. The second one is a subordinator because it introduces a subordinate clause, since the party began. And the third is an adverb because it modifies a verb and there's nothing following it. So that's the traditional analysis, three categories. So a linguist named Bas Arts, who works on the syntax of English, wrote a paper discussing the nature of categories, and he used this example. And he took the position that there was actually just one category here, which he called preposition. And so he wrote, the only difference between the different instantiations of before and since is that in the A sentences, he had more than one example, the preposition takes a nominal complement, a noun phrase. In the B sentences, it takes a clausal complement, while in the C sentences, the preposition is intransitive. So in my critique, I said, Arts does not consider the possibility that his proposed alternative to the traditional analysis is equally flawed. No reason is given for ignoring the difference in complements. Arts downplays the distributional difference by using the word only. Right up here, the only difference, as if that was unimportant. So Arts didn't like this, and he said in response, what we have are prepositions that can take different kinds of complements or no complement. And essentially, he's repeating his original analysis. He isn't actually telling us something new. So in the continuation of this paper, my criticism, I said, I'm talking about these two different analyses. So Arts analysis is what we call a lumping or a lumper analysis. One side lumps formatives together, so all these different uses of sense are one category. And the other splits them, so the traditional analysis split this into three different categories. And yet, I quote myself actually, I say, there's no a priori way to resolve the question. The lumper overlooks the mismatches in distribution, and the splitter overlooks the generalizations. So what I'm saying is not that only arts is wrong by lumping these three categories together. I'm also saying that the traditional analysis that splits them apart is wrong. So they're both wrong. Now Arts, in responding to me, said, it's not clear what exactly is meant by a mismatch in distribution if we adopt a lumping strategy, that's his own strategy, unless one insists that prepositions cannot introduce clauses and one denies the possibility that prepositions can be intransitive. Well, that may be true for since allows all three of these, but if you look at other prepositions, so-called prepositions, you'll see that some of them can't introduce clauses or they can't be intransitive. So if you take into, so you can say Joan ran into the room, but you can't say Joan is really into she flies in a balloon, or Joan walked into. Or take down. So down, you can say Randy walked down the hill, the last example. You can also say Randy looked down, but you can't say Randy looked down, the bird looked up at him. So the distribution pattern that Arts uses to say that there's just one word since, one preposition since, doesn't work for other prepositions. And then if we go beyond prepositions, so look at words, I mean, there are some words like this that do not allow a nominal complement. So you can say, she slept while I ate lunch, that's a clause, but you can't say she slept while lunch, or while my lunch. Then you have an adverb form like, I ran back, that's fine, but you can't say I ran back my office. So if you start looking not just at a word like since, but also into, down, while, and back, you'll see that in fact Arts is simply incorrect to say that there's no difference here. These words don't all act the same way. And any careful analysis of what an English speaker knows about their language will have to recognize this fact. So this is a genuine distributional analysis. It looks better on the screen because it's got three colors there. I suppose you still can't see the green very well. That's too bad, I like green, so there's a lot of green on my slides. So this is a genuine distributional analysis. It doesn't lump and it doesn't split. Each of these circles here, blue, red, and green, shows you both what is in common for each of these words and what's different about each of these words. The generalizations here are defined by constructions. So these ovals describe different constructions, color-coded. So the blue is the words that take the noun phrase complement, the red take the clausal complement, and then the green takes that no complement. And you'll see they all these words behave in many different ways, but they do share properties. So since, before, down, and back can all be adverbs. Since, before, and while can all take a clausal complement. And so on. So you can see here we've got three categories defined by three constructions, but the categories are not the traditional three categories because they overlap, but I also do not lump them all together like Arts did. But this analysis does acknowledge that since and before can occur in all three constructions. So What's the radical construction grammar view? Well, the pattern I just showed you, where these three constructions don't match, this is actually the normal state of affairs. If you look carefully at any kind of linguistic category and a range of constructions that are supposed to be possible with words of that category, and you look at every word in the category, you'll discover that, in fact, the words don't all act alike. They occur in a lot of constructions, but not all of them. And different words will occur in different constructions in ways like we just described in that simple example. And if you add some kind of exception features or special subclasses and so on, these are just essentially patches or hacks to avoid this fact. And here's the crucial point in the second bullet point. The distributional analysis presupposes the constructions used to set up the syntactic categories. That was my whole point I made, emphasizing that distributional analysis presupposes the existence of these constructions. But the building block model of syntax claims that constructions are built out of these word classes. So the constructions are used to define the word classes, and then linguists turn around and say that the word classes are the building blocks to create the constructions. So in other words, it's a circular argument, and that's the problem. So the way to avoid this circular reasoning is to say that constructions are basic and categories are derived. So we don't have prepositions as an independent category from constructions. Instead, we have constructions like noun phrase complement, clausal complement, or no complement, and those constructions define categories. But the categories don't exist independently of the constructions, because the categories were defined by the constructions. I'm afraid it's the only way that makes sense, really. It takes a long time to take this view. It took me a while to figure this out. And clearly from the discussions I've had in print and in lectures I've given, it's very difficult for many people to consider this as an alternative way to look at syntax. So, it may take you a while to see this, I hope, but I hope you'll be able to see this. Now, you find the same problem in another language. So Arts was a specialist in English, and of course I'm a native speaker of English, so it's easy to give these examples. Now let's look at a language which probably nobody in this room knows, though some of you may have looked at it. This is a language spoken in the northwest coast of the United States, Straits Salish. And here we've got two different constructions, predication and determination, and then we have words which I'll describe with semantic labels, action words like sing, object words like achieve, and property words like afraid. And you'll see that it looks like in this language you have the same construction for all three classes of words in predication. They all take those clitics, la and sch. And likewise in determination you have they all seem to look the same. So one article came out many years ago, or about 15 years ago. It was argued that this language makes no distinction between nouns and verbs because words denoting actions, objects, and properties all behave the same way, have the same distribution. A couple of other linguists working on two closely related languages said that there is a noun-verb distinction. And that's because they looked at other constructions besides the two listed on the screen and found differences. Now, Jelinek and Demers responded to them and simply said, nouns have the same syntax as any other predicate. So again, it's kind of like Arts. They simply assert that these nouns are all, these words are all alike. So it's the same problem we saw with English since, but just a different language. There's actually another problem here, which I mentioned it will become important later. The semantics of the word in this determination construction, the one on the right, is actually different. So when you combine it with an action word, it means the person who sang, the one who sang. It doesn't refer to an action, it refers to a person. And then object concepts, of course, it just means really the chief. And then in property words also refers to a person, the one who was afraid. So there's a semantic shift, and that's often ignored by people who look at the syntactic analysis. Now there's another problem here. Jelinek and Demers, when they said there's no noun-verb distinction, they concluded that this language has only verbs. Well, how do they know that? In English, we have nouns and verbs. At least that's what we all call them. But how do we know that in Salishan, that has only one category here, according to them, why do we call it verb? Why don't we call it noun? Why don't we call it something totally different? Now, I've given you this example because of a debate about nouns and verbs in this language and other languages. There's a debate about adjectives in Chinese, which I'll talk about tomorrow. Well, there is a best solution for this, but it's many linguists, especially many typologists who have to look at lots of different languages every day, have come to this conclusion for grammatical relations, but not for parts of speech. And that conclusion is in this long quotation by Matthew Dreyer. It's worth reading the whole thing. It's a very good paper of his. The search for the understanding of the similarities and differences among grammatical relations, so this is things like subject and object or ergative and absolutive, in different languages will be impeded if we make the mistake of thinking that grammatical relations as cross-linguistic categories, and will be more successful if we bear in mind that grammatical relations are unique to every language. So that was one of my points before. He goes on to say, the similarities among languages regarding grammatical relations can be explained directly in terms of functional and cognitive principles that underlie language and which cause languages to be the way they are. So I completely agree with that statement, to the point where I say this is also true for noun, verb, and adjective, not just subject and object. And I find it's quite striking that even typologists who have to deal with this cross-linguistic variation all the time also have difficulty extending this Dreyer's conclusion to parts of speech. Well, if we go back to arts, now we'll look at the problem in a cross-linguistic perspective. So before I looked just at English and showed you some problems with arts analysis, then we looked just at this other language, Straight Salish, and showed you some problems there with that analysis. So now let's look at German. So this is the one example in arts paper that's not from English. So this is a phrase that means a man who speaks several languages. So he's talking about that form that's in bold, Sprechender. And he says it has clear adjectival properties. So clear adjectival means he doesn't think there's any dispute about the category. And then he explains in parentheses, it occurs before a noun with which it agrees in case and number. Well, let's go back to English. Well, if you look at English, well, no word agrees in case. The only words that agree in number in English are this and that. You have this box, these boxes, that chair, those chairs. So I wrote in response to arts, one could say that English has only two adjectives, this and that, because they are the words in English that agree in number, just like the words in German. And then I said, if we take this option, we still have no basis for saying why agreement with the following noun is the criterion for adjective class membership. But then I suggest the other thing. One could say that there's an English adjective class which includes thin and utter, these are words that arts discussed, but not this and that. If we take the latter option, then we have no syntactic basis for assuming that the English adjective class is the same as the German adjective class. Now, I didn't say this in there, but the reason that we think that English adjectives are thin and utter, just like the German ones, is semantic, not syntactic. They denote property concepts. They are not deictic terms like this and that. So arts responded. So my point here was that if we take a construction like, does the word agree in number with the noun as our criterion for being an adjective in German, then we ought to use the same criterion in English. That when you do that, the only words that fit that criterion in English are this and that. Do we want to call them adjectives or not? So Arts in response said, as for the perceived problem that the English and German adjective classes are not the same, if the aim is to arrive at a universally valid definition for adjectives, as Croft suggests, then the same aim might be expected to apply to constructions as syntactic primitives, in Croft's sense. But given the idiosyncrasies of constructions cross-linguistically, this is unlikely to be achieved. That's my point. My point is you can't compare the words in German and English. It's just it's either based on semantics or just based on historical tradition that we call them adjectives in both German and English. It's not based on syntax of the two languages. And of course, as you know already, I said one of my points about radical construction grammar is that constructions are not the same across languages. So of course, I agree with that point that Arts makes. Okay, now here's another response. So Arts is a linguist who analyzes English. So he's just looking at one language. As I said, there are a lot of typologists who look at many languages, myself included, of course. And one of them had a discussion about nouns and verbs in a language called Munda, or two of them, Nick Evans and Osada. And again, I wrote a critique of their analysis, and they responded to it. And my critique was that you can't just use any old construction, because basically what you do is you already decide in advance whether your language has nouns and verbs, and then you just find a construction that distinguishes them. Or if you already decide in advance that the language doesn't have a noun-verb distinction, then you just find another construction which doesn't distinguish them. And that doesn't really tell you much of anything about nouns and verbs. So they responded that although the exact criteria linguists use differ from language to language, the distributional tests are not a random grab bag. They exaggerated a little bit from what I said. Some properties of members of a particular class turn out to be excellent predictors of other properties, so that one can set up chains of dependencies between properties. Well, I agree with a lot of what they say, but they actually hide something here. That these things called properties, and I might add, I should have put another arrow up to criteria here. These are constructions, because these properties, they're just the properties, tests, criteria of the distributional method, and the distributional method is defined as constructions. So when they talk about one property predicting another property, what they're really telling you about is one construction predicting something about another construction. So it's a fact about constructions. So once again, this is why I am a construction grammarian. So in my critique here, I point out that when you're looking at parts of speech like noun, verb, and adjective, as Evans and Osada were doing, these use a certain constructions that I call propositional act constructions. So predication, modification, reference. I'm going to talk about that again tomorrow with Cantonese. So I say the propositional act constructions are, of course, the constructions that figure prominently in discussions of parts of speech: referring expression constructions, predicating constructions, and modifying constructions. Since the universals are specific to the mapping between these constructions and lexical items, the supposed word classes, we have a principled reason to set aside the distributional facts about other constructions. I'm kind of jumping ahead here, but my point is that, you know, I said, what Evans and Osada are talking about are constructions. Some constructions are good predictors of other constructions. But there are lots of constructions in a language, zillions of them. How do you pick the ones that you want to study, the ones where you think there are going to be some interesting universal relationships of prediction or implication? Well, you look at the constructions themselves and the kind of functions they perform. So reference, predication, and modification are fundamental ways in which you package information in a clause. So you might guess that they would be interconnected. And things like transitive versus intransitive, that's a fact about argument structure constructions. Those are different kinds of constructions. You might not expect them to have any connection to reference, predication, and modification. And in general, they don't. So you leave them out. So you can just pick certain constructions, but the main thing is you have to be honest about what you're talking about. You're analyzing properties of constructions, not properties of word classes. Okay, so where am I going here? Okay, distributional analysis and universal syntactic elements. So distributional analysis, this is a very important point here. Distributional analysis is independent of the assumption of these universal syntactic elements as building blocks of grammar. So distributional analysis has always been used to support the building block theory of grammar, but they're actually, they don't depend on each other. And in fact, anybody who is careful of looking at the distributional facts in languages will easily find evidence that undermines the building block theory of grammar. So if you're going to be one of those people, you have to, your assumption of universal syntactic elements must be reconciled with language internal and cross-linguistic diversity. Well, my point is that you can't. So people make up extra hypotheses to save this assumption of universal syntactic elements, and this results, hypotheses are basically what I call methodological opportunism. Methodological opportunism, I forgot to say, that's the when you pick whatever construction you want that will either prove the existence of categories you already believe to exist or to deny the existence of categories that you already believe don't exist. So it's got the cart before the horse, as we say in English, that you shouldn't assume what categories exist in a language and then look for constructions that fit it. You should look at the constructions consistently from one language to the next and then see what the facts are. And a classic example of methodological opportunism is a theory about parts of speech by a generative linguist who does do a lot of cross-linguistic comparison, Mark Baker. So he wrote a book about this. And by the way, this came out because several years ago, I was invited to actually co-teach a course with Mark Baker. It was supposed to be a dialogue course between two diametrically opposed views about grammar. And it was very interesting. I mean, I like Mark a lot. We got along quite fine and all, but I'm sure we didn't really understand each other. But as a result, of course, I read his book very carefully because the course was about parts of speech. And so I've looked fairly carefully at his arguments, and that's why I'm able to give you some details here. And this is a part of the analysis here is part of a paper that I published that was actually a kind of written out version of my final presentation, my final lecture in this team course, this course that I taught with Mark Baker. So in his theory, this is a theory about universal categories. So he's talking about nouns and adjectives across languages. And he says they require a category pred and predication, and verbs do not require that. His justification for this syntactic analysis is the frequent need for a copular element to appear with predicate adjectives and nouns, but not verbs. He says that's a reflection of the fact that nouns and adjectives are never predicates in and of themselves. Well, of course, this is very English-based, because in English, nouns and adjectives require a copula verb. You know, she is a professor, she is tall. And verbs don't. She sings. Just the kind of examples I used at the beginning of this afternoon's lecture. Ironically, however, Baker says that the English copula, B, is actually not an example of his syntactic category pred in his theory. The reason is because B actually, even though it's used to predicate nouns and adjectives, it's not used in a couple of other important constructions. So in secondary predication, example one below, the poisoned food made Chris sick, or made Chris an invalid. You don't use the copula B there. So for him, that means that the copula B is not a pred. And then the fact that if you said something like Chris is dying, you have to have the copula with this participle construction. And he said that is also evidence, notice evidence, another construction that he looks at that's, for him, means that English B is not pred. Of course, the problem now, I think of it as a problem. In some respects, it's an advantage. Pred is no longer a concrete syntactic element. So you can find it wherever you want to, because there's no concrete syntactic element in a language that it corresponds to. So you could just pick what you want. So he did some work on an African language called Edo. And this language has a form called Ye, which he claims does fall in the category pred, because unlike the English form, it is required in secondary predication. It also occurs in another construction that's what he calls a floating quantifier construction. And then this ye cannot occur in other constructions. So the examples below, which you can see in your handout packet, illustrate the first two points. It made the bell long. Sentence one is bad because ye is not there. It's supposed to be there. The second sentence shows you that this thing that's translated as by himself or by oneself is what he calls a quantifier, and you can put it before the pred element ye. So for him, that's another piece of evidence that ye is his abstract category pred. So those of you who have read articles in syntax in the generative tradition or other traditions, this kind of argumentation should look familiar to you. You look in one language and you see a few constructions and the word works in a certain way, has a certain distribution, so you can say, come to a conclusion like this word is pred or this word is not pred. Well, from a typologist's point of view, Baker's comparison of English and Edo actually is implying some kind of universal claims. After all, for Baker, pred is part of his universal model of syntax. So he's making a claim about all languages, not just English and Edo. And what exactly is that claim? Well, basically, you have to look at every construction that he refers to in his discussion of English and Edo and put all those into consideration, because if occurrence in a particular construction in Edo is evidence for pred in Edo, then that same construction ought to be evidence for pred in any other language. So since he invoked, I think, of five or six constructions, it's actually a very complicated statement. He's making a claim that this copula word or pred word has to occur in a whole bunch of constructions or not occur in a whole bunch of constructions across languages. Well, that's not, so that's there. And in some sense, Baker doesn't say this, obviously, but it's implicit in his discussion. So he goes to another African language, which he's done some research on, called Chichewa. And the claim that was made in that previous slide, go back, the thing in blue, this big long statement here, actually, the next language he looks at, this statement doesn't work. So Chichewa has a form, this D, and this form does not occur in secondary predication. And remember, that was supposed to be a requirement for being pred. But Baker thinks that this element in Chichewa is pred. Well, what is he? So now he has to come up with an explanation in Chichewa why that element is pred, even though it does not occur in secondary predication. So he explains this by looking at two more constructions. So he says that in Chichewa, the secondary predication is in a subjunctive form. And that's the reason why you don't find D there. He also says that D does not have a morphological causative form in the language. And so that's another reason why it's sort of like it really is pred. So in other words, he's gone to another language. He finds that his assumptions for the first two languages don't fit. So then he brings in two more constructions in this other language in an attempt to explain why this element really is pred. The sentence below just illustrates this for the secondary predication. You have to have it in the subjunctive. Okay, so basically what that means is now if you add a third language, Chichewa, then you have to reformulate this biconditional universal with the two extra facts that he brought in for Chichewa. And those things are in italics. So this statement is the same as the previous one, two slides back, but for the elements that are in italics. So this is a very cumbersome way of trying to construct language universals. That's because essentially what he's doing is he starts with one language decides what the facts are. He goes to the next language. It doesn't fit, so he adds a couple more constructions. He looks for a couple more constructions to make the facts fit his assumption. Then he goes to a third language, and the facts don't fit the assumptions of those, or the extra constructions in the first, in the second language, so he has to invoke two more constructions, and this can go on and on. The next language, you've got to do the same thing. And he goes on with like five languages this way. So what are the problems with the strategy? Well, basically what it means is, if you're looking for a category, a universal category that you've already believe exists, so this is really a belief, not a empirically testable hypothesis. Methodological opportunism, the ability to choose any construction you want, allows you to just justify the category that you want because, as I said, languages are quite variable and they're very complex. So you can almost always find a construction to lump together two categories you want lumped together, or split apart two categories you want to split apart. So in other words, you can assume that there's a universal syntactic category, whether it's verb or pred or whatever, or subject, no matter what the diversity of the actual facts are within languages or across languages. Now, the approach that Baker has taken is to go one language at a time. So you start with English, then you move on to Edo, and adjust your, pick different constructions, then you move on to Chichewa, pick other constructions, and keep going one language at a time. Well, if you keep doing this, as you can see from the example I gave you, you keep adding more and more constructions, and you get a bigger and bigger statement that has to be true of all languages, and yet the reality is it doesn't work very well. And in fact, the important reality is that linguists who use this method of argumentation almost never test the implicit universals they claim in a large sample of languages. So what would be a truly rigorous syntactic method? I mean, basically what I've spent this afternoon telling you is that the standard way that most linguists, not just generative syntacticians, but most linguists argue for categories, word classes or other kinds of syntactic categories, these building blocks, is flawed. It's not really respecting the empirical facts of language, the diversity of languages. So what would be a truly rigorous method? The reason I make this point in this way is because some syntacticians make a big deal about the fact or the belief that they are using a rigorous method of syntactic argumentation in order to support their analyses. And so my point here is that actually the method they use is actually not rigorous at all. It's very sloppy. So the question you might ask is there a rigorous way to do this that is not sloppy? And the answer is yes. Whoops. Got to go forward here. So the first point I make is cross-linguistic validation of hypotheses. So any hypothesis about constructions that we saw of the type that Baker used must be tested against a broad cross-linguistic sample. It doesn't have to be a huge sample. You don't have to go out and look at 100 languages like some typologists do. It's actually more important that if you look at your languages that you make sure the languages are from different parts of the world, geographically, and they're from different genetic groupings. Looking at just Western European languages or just East Asian languages is not going to be sufficient. The other thing is to use the same constructions across languages for argumentation. My whole point is that when you do syntactic argumentation, what you're really doing is you're asking what words or phrases can fill a particular role in a particular grammatical construction. Well, if that's how you operate, then you, to be rigorous, you need to look at the same role and the same construction across languages. That can guarantee that you're looking at the same thing across languages, and therefore you can actually find something that might be universal about languages. The other thing you should do is examine distributional patterns in detail. Part of the problem with Art's analysis of synths is that he, at least in the article, he only looked at since and before, which works the same way. He didn't look at into and while and back and down, the other forms that I mentioned. If you look at more forms, then you'll discover some of this variation and you'll get a more accurate description of what's really going on in the language. And then if you have a problem in your analysis and you bring in another construction to try to understand what's going on, well, you're doing that for one particular language. But if you're going to say this other construction explains what's going on, you know, some problem in your analysis, then you have to look at that construction across other languages. The explanation isn't valid as a universal explanation if it only works for one language. I mean, that just really means that it doesn't really work. It's not the real explanation. That is, the explanation is just ad hoc. And that, I think, is the basic problem with Baker's analysis that we saw there. And then here's the toughest thing. You need to use cross-linguistically valid criteria to identify potentially universal patterns. This is perhaps the most important criterion of all. And here the problem is, so to speak, if you look at grammatical structure, as I've emphasized again and again, there's a huge amount of diversity across languages. And you'll see this as we continue with more lectures in this, in my series of lectures. So you can't really use formal grammatical structure for cross-linguistic comparison. That's what you know, the statistical types call the dependent variable. You need to have something that you can use as the basis of comparison across languages that's different from formal structure. And the truth is, the only fully valid criterion is functional equivalence. So if you're talking about, say, predication, what you're doing is you're comparing predication as a function, a way of packaging information in a clause from one language to the next. How a particular, what formal structure a language uses, well, that's what you're interested in learning about. Which formal constructions do they use and how do they use it? So you look for, to compare constructions across languages, you look at constructions that perform the same function. And again, that's why I'm a construction grammarian, because in construction grammar, constructions are a combination of formal structures and their function. So you can compare constructions based on their function or meaning. Since I'm running out of time, I just want to say there's some formal properties that you think you might be able to compare across languages, but they actually almost all require they all require some degree of functional equivalence. I won't go into the details here. Now, what I've described so far is basically the typological method. Any textbook in typology, such as the one that I wrote, will tell you about this in the first chapter. So our conclusion here, how does this connect to radical construction grammar? I've taken you on looking at some examples of cross-linguistic comparison and said that the only rigorous syntactic method is the typological method. Well, constructions, which are pairings of form and meaning, are ideally suited for cross-linguistic comparison and cross-linguistic validation of linguistic hypotheses. So again, that's why typologists are or should be construction grammarians. Distributional analysis is based on constructions. Linguists may call it other kinds of things, but the truth is they're talking about constructions and roles in constructions. Therefore, typological universals, that is, genuine universals about language, are universals about constructions functionally defined and not about categories formally defined. And I think that's the end of my story for today. Yes. Thank you.